So it's episode number 100, and originally I had a whole plan for what I was going to do with that, a whole special, if you will. But with the hiatus coming ever closer, I decided I'll just save all those festivities for the very end. But in the meantime, it is 100 episodes, and I'm shocked we've even gotten this far. I can't thank you listeners enough, and we do have a fun one for you today, and please join me as I welcome my guest, Sarah Bennett Wheeler, as we talk about more Edith Wharton with The House of Mirth. Welcome to your favorite book. All right, so Sarah, welcome to the show today. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
It is so great to have you here, and I'm telling you this pretty on the spot, but you're actually our 100th episode of your favorite book.
Oh, I'm honored. That's awesome.
Completely unintentionally, but I realized I came right up on the milestone, and I'm like, you know what? We're just going to celebrate that right now. So stuck with it for a
Congratulations.
while. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I certainly hope the weather is good for you where you're at.
Yes, we have not received any of the hurricane-related rain yet, but I have so many friends in Florida, and I'm kind of watching with my teeth clenched. I'm just hoping everybody stays safe.
Absolutely, absolutely. As everyone on the show probably knows, because I've talked about it before, I grew up in Florida, raised there, don't live there anymore, but the hurricane prepping, I'm certainly no stranger to. So definitely our thoughts go out to everyone preparing for the storm right now and hope everyone's staying safe. But, on a somewhat lighter note, we're here to talk about this book that you've written, which is such a fun, interesting read. I think there's a lot to dig into here. And also about, a book that's probably the polar opposite in terms of tone and style and age, but that's what makes conversations fun. And so, Sarah, let's jump in a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself and about your books?
I'm an author living in Ohio, Cincinnati, Ohio, just a kind of a Midwestern girl, like a mom. And I write, I'm marketing by day, and then by night I write my novels. So I write for young adults. And the latest book that comes out actually next month in a few days, October 11th, is called Grave Things Like Love. It's my fourth young adult novel to be published, and I'm really excited because this is the first one I've done that kind of has a little it's not really a Halloween story, but it's a little bit of a spooky season type, seasonal vibe going there, and it's kind of the first time I've had a book that kind of matches up nicely with a season or a holiday. So I'm excited for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I was going to point out, yeah, an October release and certainly very appropriate for the season. It's a nice blend of sort of these paranormal elements and the contemporary YA story. And I'm actually, in let's start with that. I'm actually really interested in that. The ghost hunting, the paranormal aspects of the book. Did you have these interests kind of from the beginning, or did you kind of pick them up when you were in like planning the rest of the story? I'm just wondering which element came first.
Yeah, well, the very first element that came to me was the funeral home and the idea of a teenager growing up in a family-owned funeral home. I had spent quite a bit of time at a family-owned funeral home at a former job because I was a newspaper reporter. I was thinking I was going to write a feature story about these folks, and they lived in this big Victorian house. They operated a funeral home down below, and they lived up above. And I thought it would be really cool to write a story about a teenager growing up in that setting. So I had that first, and I wrote one draft that I turned in to my editors, and it was just basically it just was really kind of didn't go anywhere. There was like nothing exciting happening, and I had to kind of give myself permission to have some fun with it and just brainstorm a little bit. And my husband and I, way back when, if I feel old now, but when ghost hunting TV shows were first getting to be popular, they're like everywhere now, but for a while there was just a couple that were just getting started, and that was our date night thing. We would sit and watch. We'd go out to dinner, and then we come home and we watch these ghost hunting shows. So I just remembered that feeling. There was one where they locked a family in a haunted house, and I always said my husband and his brothers and sisters should get on a show like that. So I thought, okay, so that felt like a fun hook. Like, you know, this girl lives in this house, and her family runs a business that, you know, is in a very important service to the community. But it's definitely deals with things that people have questions about, that people make assumptions about, or that people might be afraid of. And, you know, there might be logically some assumptions somebody might make that, oh, that's a funeral home, it's haunted. And so it kind of all flowed from there, you know, that maybe, she would meet a new kid in town who wants to ghost hunt in her house. By she, I'm talking about Lane, the main character. Mm-hmm. And then that would kind of open up a lot of opportunities for Elaine to explore just, you know, the house where she lives and has grown up, but also start to explore how much she wants to continue on in the family business and kind of what she really wants to do with her life. She's doesn't have to figure it all out. Obviously she's just a teenager, but she is in a business where you kind of have to start thinking about that, you know, relatively early, especially if your family runs the place. And so, you know, having that character come in of Xander, the ghost hunting, I liked the way it opened up doors for some fun, but also to push Elaine out of her comfort zone.
And I like that sort of organic process that it came together. And I'm laughing at the idea of watching ghost hunting shows as a date night thing. I'm like, I feel like I've just been subjecting my husband to the Great British Baking Show, but
oh yeah,
it expanded to some ghost hunting shows. But yeah, I like what you brought in with Elaine kind of figuring herself out. That's kind of like the inner conflict of the story. And I think one of the things that was most compelling to me was Elaine's relationship with her parents. And, you know, she works in this family-owned business. And I feel like all of us, maybe we've been to like a family-owned restaurant or what have you, and you've seen like kids working there, little kids, teens, you know, working at the family business. And I guess it never really struck me in a serious way the kind of impact that can have on someone's social development or, you know, their expectations for the future, you know, what they have to carry on their shoulders. It just feels like there's fewer and fewer family businesses these days.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, you know, kind of what went into that thought process of, you know, creating this family business and having Elaine kind of be stuck in the role that's been defined for her.
Yeah. Well, to that point, the fact that there are fewer and fewer family businesses is sort of a little bit of what drives the stakes, mm-hmm. you know, for Elaine, because, you know, I'm not going to say I'm an expert in the funeral business. I know enough, I know enough that I needed to know to write the book, but one thing I do know is that, you know, family owned funeral homes are also, you know, there are just fewer and fewer of them as well. And so, you know, especially for somebody like Elaine, I always conceived her as, I feel like she's one of my characters who's the most like me. She's just very dutiful, she's the oldest child, kind of has that, really wants to live up to everybody's expectations. And that setting that she's in, where she is kind of expected, or, you know, sometimes maybe I play a little bit in the book with, is she really expected to do all that, or is she taking it on herself? Like, where's that line?
Yep.
But, you know, she's the one who steps up to play piano for the services. She's the one that steps up to work the guest books, or to, you know, help drive the family-owned hearse. Mm-hmm. There's a horse-drawn hearse that she drives at the beginning in a parade. It's like the advertisement for the funeral home. She does all that because she doesn't want to let anybody down. And, you know, because the stakes are kind of high in a family-owned business, if you can feel like you are letting somebody down, because, you know, what if nobody else takes it on? What if nobody continues it? Are you the one that kind of causes this legacy in your family to end or change? And it's a lot. So I liked that as a writer. It was a nice conflict to play with and explore especially in a character, like I said, that really already does kind of have these tendencies to just be very dutiful, to not want to let people down, you know, kind of a bit of a type A. She has anxiety like I do, you know, and she's just kind of a ball of nerves there, and she needs to step out of her comfort zone and explore what she really wants.
Yeah, and I like that point you made about not knowing if these things are all expected of her or what she's just choosing to take on, because there is that aspect that she feels like she's compensating for the fact that her younger sister has already seemed to be written off in so many ways. It's like the kid no one can control and the kid we can't get to help, and, you know, has kind of written her off. And that pigeonholes her too into certain roles. And I feel like that was just an interesting dynamic to play with. The family dynamics definitely felt real to me. And the next thing I wanted to touch on, actually, you just mentioned, and it's Elaine struggles with anxiety. And you're very specific in naming it as generalized anxiety disorder. You talk about Elaine's experiences with medication and therapy and her coping strategies and things like that. You know, what made you want to get specific about anxiety in this context?
Because I think that it's easy for somebody who already has a personality that is just kind of driven to please, and you know, is kind of in an older sibling role. It's sometimes easy to tell yourself that this feeling of dread that you have, or this constant feeling of this buzzing feeling that something's not right or something is going to go wrong if you don't do just this right thing, or it's easy to say, oh, well, that's just my personality. I'm just type A. That's just how it is. But, you know, I've learned in my life, that at a certain point, you know, for me, it kind of got to a point where it was bigger than that. And I had to really grapple with what was going on, and it was freeing to understand that, you know, and actually look back in my family and see the threads of anxiety and depression that were kind of went unnoticed or untalked about or untreated, and realized for myself that that I kind of carry a little bit of that with me, and I have ways that I can live with them. And I just thought it was important for people to see that if something doesn't feel right, you don't always have to write it. I'm struggling. it's easy to assume that this is just how you are. This is just how it is. And sometimes you will live with it longer than you maybe need to. So being able to have somebody help name what's going on and offer some help and show some strategies, I think, is constructive. I wanted to be constructive, especially since, you know, now I have kids of my own, and, you know, they have a little bit of that legacy, family legacy too. So we're working on it. I think it's important to just talk about and normalize.
Right. Absolutely. And I'm thinking, you know, from your readers' perspectives, you know, the teens that are picking this book up, I mean, I'm sure many will see Elaine and identify with Elaine and feel like, oh, maybe this is what I have too. And maybe that can start them on a path to healing and a path to coping. And yeah. I feel like it's something, you know, you hope for as a writer, that people will be able to take something positive out of what you've written. So I thought the representation, I mean, it made a lot of sense as someone who struggles with anxiety myself. Mm-hmm. I definitely felt that her thought patterns and ruminations and all felt very familiar, especially in that teenage context. There's nothing more anxiety provoking than being like 16 years old and trying to figure out life. And
right.
Without a diagnosis, like, it's a stressful time in your life.
It's stressful anyway. And if your brain chemistry is kind of fighting you a little bit, you know, that's certainly not helpful. you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't know, I just enjoyed the characters of this story. I like that Elaine is just, you know, she's got her quirks and her interests of her own, and she's conflicted throughout the story about what she wants and how to handle all the interpersonal relationships. I like her friends. I like the boys in the story. They all bring something to the table here. I don't know, it's a charming cast of characters. It's perfect for the spooky season. And I think, you know, for anyone looking for a YA read around these lines, I mean, this is a great book to pick up.
Thank you. I loved reading it. And I'm glad it's now getting out, or reading it. Sorry. I mean, I loved writing it.
I'm sure you had to read it too.
No, yeah, I've read it a million times. Yes, yes.
That's always the annoying part of writing. It's like when I edit my podcast, I'm like, oh, I have to listen to my own voice over and over. Yeah. It's like that with reading your own work.
Somebody joked on Twitter, they were like, everybody says, write the book you want to read because you will read it 100 times.
It's so true. Oh my gosh. Well, so I want to take all of this and switch gears entirely to the book you chose for this episode, which, like I said, couldn't be more different, although it is about a young woman trying to figure out what she wants. And in that respect, you know, there's a similarity. Yeah. But here we're talking about The House of Mirth by Edith Wharton. And for all of you longtime listeners, we've talked about Edith Wharton on the show before. We talked about The Age of Innocence last year. It was one of my favorite books that I read last year. I've been a longtime fan of Edith Wharton.
Yes.
I was that one like morose 14-year-old who Ethan Frome was like my favorite book ever. it's so sad, but I loved it so much. And then, but this one I hadn't read until, you know, we planned this episode. And so I had high expectations. And of course, it's Edith Wharton. It absolutely delivered. This book was another showstopper. Oh my gosh.
Yes.
And so before we dive in, Sarah, I always like to ask guests, you know, when did you first read this book and what kind of impact did it have on you?
So I read The House of Mirth in my middle 20s when I was just getting out into the world and starting a career on my own. You know, a kind of around the age of Lily Bart, who's the main character. There was something about her, that I identified with so deeply. I don't think it's a spoiler to say, you know, she's a young woman who's grown up in privilege, but, her immediate family has lost their money and she's maintained this lifestyle of privilege, kind of reliant on the beneficiaries of the generosity of friends, mm-hmm.
Right.
and expected to marry well. But she really does not have a safety net.
Yep.
And she, kind of makes some, she's so, I like her because she makes these dumb decisions at these key points that really kind of self-sabotage herself. But I think it impacted me so much because I was at an age where, you know, I didn't grow up wealthy, but I did grow up with quite a bit of privilege, and I always knew I could call my mom or dad for help if I needed it. But I was out on my own and kind of starting to realize the limits of my charm and talents, and starting to come to terms with the idea that I was a grown-up and able to make big grown-up mistakes, and was very grateful that I had a strong support system of, I knew if I ever got into trouble that it would be okay. But with Lily, she just doesn't have anybody to help make it okay.
Yeah.
I won't spoil any more than that, but, you know, it just touched me so much because the story, all the mistakes she made and the situation she found herself in, I just wanted to help her. And I knew there, but for the grace of my mom and dad, could go I, mm-hmm. you know? At the end of it, it's one of the only books that I've just bawled, you know, I just cried. It just touched me so much. And even now I reread it and getting ready to talk with you. And even now I keep hoping I haven't quite finished it yet, but I'm like, I keep hoping, Lily, maybe it will go, it'll be okay. Maybe it'll be different this time when I read this book. You know? Because Edith Wharton has such a great way too of getting you in the head of the characters, and if Lily's hopeful, then I'm hopeful. And
yes.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. That reading experience, it's like, you know, if you know anything about Edith Wharton, like, you know that this is not going to end with sunshine and rainbows. I mean, it's not a spoiler to say that. I mean, this woman, I don't think is capable of writing a happy ending. Like, no. The Age of Innocence, I bawled. Ethan Frome bawled. This book, similar. Oh my gosh. But she writes, they're not just like doom and gloom throughout. That's not how these books function. It's very much a character study. And it brings you, especially with Lily, brings you so close to this character to the point where you are getting to know her every thought, her every calculation. This whole society game she's playing is just a big chess game with everybody. And you're getting to know her every calculating move. And it brings you so close to her. So whether or not you like her, you're along for the ride with her. Like, there's no getting off this ship or this yacht, if you will.
Yes. Well, and, you know, because of that, you know, you're right. There's a dry humor to Wharton's writing. It's so biting. And she's even biting to characters like Lily. And as I was rereading it, does Edith Wharton like Lily Bart? But the more I've read, the more I'm like, you know what? You can't help but like a person who is completely unable to play the game that everybody else is playing at a certain point, because, you know, at a certain point, her whatever foibles or shallowness or, you know, kind of dumb stuff she does, or, you know, lack of character she has, is so overshadowed by the, just, you said I could swear, the assholery of the rich people around her, who are never going to feel a consequence of any, they're not playing the high stakes that she is.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so at the end, I'm crying because, you know, even though, and Lily even says, I am a shallow person. She's like, I like beautiful things. I like money, you know, and Edith Wharton even describes her like, well, there goes Lily again. She knew she was in trouble, but she could forget about it because it was pretty in the countryside. And you're like, ah!
You're so frustrated with Lily. There are like 1,001 opportunities for her to change courses in some way, shape, or form. And like, the book will even tell you, and it's like, and this was another place where Lily made a grave mistake. And I'm like, oh boy, here we go.
And not only that, but Lily knew she was making a mistake.
Lily knew.
And she could just make it up later, you know?
From the very beginning, you know, she plays like she's not running out of time, even though she's also plainly aware that she is running out of time. Of course, we're using this in the antiquated 29 is an old maid kind of standpoint. And she's like, oh no, I'm drying up with every passing day. But she acts like she's a fresh-faced 18-year-old and she doesn't need to make decisions so quickly. And I mean, the book is pretty self-aware about it. And you bring up, you know, do we think Edith Wharton likes Lily Bart? And honestly, I don't think she does. I don't think Edith Wharton likes Lily. I don't think I like Lily, but I understand Lily.
Mm-hmm.
It's because Edith Wharton understands women like Lily. They know what they have to do. You know, whether or not we like her, like, this is how she's able to make her way in the world. We've seen, you know, when she tries to do other things, it just doesn't work for her.
Yeah. And, you know, I read a little bit more about Edith Wharton's life in general. And she, I think, was acutely aware of kind of how women were expected to function in that society. And you're right. Maybe she doesn't like Lily, but I think she is trying to show what happens to a woman who doesn't keep up with the game and doesn't make the quote unquote right choice for whatever reason, you know, and it's not great.
And I think it's a testament to how Edith Wharton writes this character and writes all these characters, because, you are left asking the question, is Lily's downfall due to herself or society? Where I feel like in the hands of a less skilled writer, it's clearly one or the other. But here, it's a complicated mix of the two. At times it's Lily, at times it's the world around her, at times she is a victim, at times she's very much not a victim. And she's a complex character through and through, even, and we're seeing it through her eyes. And, you know, my opinion of her changed so rapidly through the story. And I'm just like, you know, we're getting a full, well-rounded picture of a well-written character.
Right, right. And then, you know, just, I think another thing that spoke to me was just kind of her loneliness, you know, especially, you know, toward the end of the book, she just really, yeah, it touched me. And I know even if we don't love her, I have pity on somebody who's just kind of realizing, you know, that they're just not. Okay. So do you know Pygmalion, like My Fair Lady? Okay. Mm-hmm. You know, the scene where Liza comes back, they come back from the ball and she's so mad at Henry Higgins. She says, "What have you made me good for?"
Yes.
She's like, you taught me all this. You pulled me out of the gutter and you've given me all these skills that I can't use. And now I can't even sell hats anymore. Yes. And what have you made me good for? And, you know, I kind of felt, that's kind of how I feel about Lily in the end too. She's not been able to be made good for anything, you know.
Down to hats.
Yeah, she can't even make hats.
That's such a great point, because so many times Lily does refer to it as her training, as her upbringing. You know, this is how I was raised. You know, I was, and her, you literally see her from childhood. You know, her family loses its fortune, but the idea is Lily is their salvation. She has that faith. She's so beautiful that she'll marry well and gain it all back. And she's pretty much bred for this purpose. And then when her own will comes into play with what, I mean, this is kind of tying into your book a little bit, when your family wants one thing for you, but you want something else for yourself, or you just want the opportunity to make that decision for yourself, you inherently come into conflict like this.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
And
yeah,
so,
No. I think that you're right. Yep.
And so I wanted to bring in some of the other characters here, because I mean, Lily is the focal point of this book, but we get introduced to quite a broad set of characters here. And I find it interesting you really brought up Lily's loneliness, because even though there are so many people in this book, Lily has very few true relationships with anyone, you know, anything beyond surface level. And that's what contributes to her loneliness. So when she's not surrounded by her giant crowd, even though they were shallow, they were somebody.
Right. I think,
you know, she has some true conversations with someone like Gertie Farish or Lawrence Selden and Rosedale and a few other characters come in, but most of the people in her life, it's very superficial and just, you know, not that intimacy she craves.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting, you know, that the one person she really does go to and really bear her soul to, Gertie, is one of the people that she looks down on the most.
Yes.
And what do you think about Selden? I think I hate him.
Selden?
Is he worthless? I don't know. I can't tell.
I think the thing is, the other men in the book are so worthless that Selden looks like a prince next to them.
Yeah.
That's how I feel. The Wharton has no mercy on the men in this book.
Yeah.
Like, the men in this book are just like, you know, this is not, and I mean, if you look at, say, The Age of Innocence, Newland Archer is no prize, but like compared to the men of the House of Mirth, I mean, Selden, I think, makes an effort, but I mean, you compare it to like Trenor and George Dorset. Oh God, I couldn't read George Dorset after a while.
Oh, I know.
But all the men here are just absolutely hopeless and pathetic.
Yeah, well, you know, and I've read the book so many times, but I still don't quite understand. You know, Selden is always I can't marry you, Lily, and you know why not? I guess maybe he just couldn't keep her, and he knows that she would not be as glamorous a lifestyle as she would want, I suppose.
That's what I always thought. I mean, you know, from the beginning, it just seemed like, you know, he's more solidly middle class than any of the other people. He's the only, this is always the thing that strikes me about these society novels. He's the only one who has anything to do. Nobody else does anything. He has a job.
He can go off to Nice forever. Like, he,
I mean, it's a pretty cushy job, but I'm also thinking, like, everyone else, like, how do you not get bored? Just, I mean, it sounds luxurious, but also, like, how many dinners can you eat in, like...
Yeah. Well, then you become like George Dorset and you just complain about all the dinner. Like,
oh my God. He's like, oh, this one's going to give me acid reflux. And I'm like, ooh, George. Like,
yeah.
It's too, because you see that same perspective when Lily does sort of encounter the working class in a few different instances. Mm-hmm. And you kind of see what they go through compared to like what Lily's idea of like squalor or Lily's idea of poor fortunes are. Like, there's a whole scene where Lily's like, what, you mean they're working? When she like finds out that these two acquaintances are trying to find jobs. And it just really goes to show like the 20th century, like the early 20th century was such a different world for the upper class.
Yeah. Yeah, for real. Well, and also there really wasn't any, you know, quote, we can talk a lot about whether there is much of a safety net today, but mm-hmm. you know, back then there truly wasn't. Like, if you hit the pavement, you were hitting the concrete, you know. There was, I just feel like, you know, there wasn't a lot. If you weren't resourceful and you couldn't, there just wasn't, I don't think, anything to help cushion any sort of a fall, you know?
Exactly. And I think what adds to kind of back then's lack of safety net towards now is now you see sort of a moral safety net that you need too. Like, not only do you have to have financial backing to support yourself, you also need to have just a good reputation in society. I mean, I think Lily's first downfall has to do with her reputation first and foremost. Like, her poverty could have been forgiven up to a point, but when reputation plays into that, you know, that's something money can't always buy.
Well, true. And I think we see that in a lot, in some of the, you know, I know like Jane Austen is like way earlier than mm-hmm. Edith Wharton, but the whole, you know, within the circles, there are, you know, people with a lot less money, but they're still allowed into society and held in high esteem because they have a good reputation. You know, it's a whole way of thinking about society and, you know, and Lily, I don't know. I just think she gets weary of having to think about her reputation all the time, you know?
And, you know, she says it, you know, from the beginning, why does a girl have to do so much just to keep her head above water, pretty much? You know, there's so much she has to be conscious of, and she just gets tired. She gets tired to the point of sleeplessness. She gets tired to the point where she's just like, I have so many strings I need to pull at once to try to make anything of myself. It's all about security. You brought Jane Austen into it. I always like to describe Edith Wharton as Jane Austen, but everyone's a little more desperate.
Yeah. Yes.
And a little more bitter. yes. That's that idea of like the safety net thing too. I mean, a lot of people like to deride Mrs. Bennet for like caring so much about getting her daughters married, but she knew that was the only way that they were going to make a living for themselves, is to get those daughters married. And it's similar. You have to play the games of the society you live in.
Yeah. Yeah. And but it's funny how quickly a lot of that changed, because, you know, you were going to ask me about, I think you'd mentioned we would have ended up talking about like a new book recommendation. I'll say again to you, a book I'm reading right now, it's a nonfiction. It's about, it's called Empty Mansions. It's about Huguette Clark, who was the reclusive heiress to the Clark fortune. And and Clark was a robber baron back during Wharton's time. I don't know if he's actually a robber baron, but he, in coal and in Montana. And then he moved to New York City. And it was this whole milieu that this Huguette grew up in. But then she ended up living to be like 100 or something. And one of the things that struck me in the scope of that book was how rapidly things modernized kind of from then up till now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know where I'm going with that, but that whole idea that, you know, a woman must marry well in order to even live, and your reputation is the most important thing. I mean, I think we've come at least a long way, a little bit of a long way.
A little bit. But yeah, that's a good point. You know, modernization, I feel like, happened so quickly in the grand scheme of things. And I'm glad you brought a nonfiction book into conversation here, because I'll put all the links to the books we talk about in the show notes. So for anyone interested, you'll be able to read them. I went in kind of a different direction with my recommendation since we're here. I mean, obviously, if you like one Edith Wharton, definitely read her other books. Age of Innocence is my favorite. Ethan Frome is great. I have The Custom of the Country on my shelf, which I intend to read. But she's written so many and they're all great. But I think if you're looking for sort of a, if you wanted Lily Bart to end up a little bit better off, I think Persuasion by Jane Austen would be a good pairing for this one.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had an episode on Persuasion. Brandon Taylor had lovely things to say about it. But we talked a lot about that. And I think it's, you know, a similar situation, a woman in her later 20s, you know, taking scope of past choices in her life and making difficult decisions and, you know, dealing with a more mature storyline. So that's definitely a good one. And then another thing, and this sort of came to me, this is totally different. I mean, this is a short story, first of all. Mm-hmm. This is a short story called Geese by Zizi Packer. It's in her collection Drinking Coffee Elsewhere, which I read recently. But Geese is a story in which a young woman post-college moves to Japan for a short amount of time. She's a young Black woman and she moves to Japan. And basically she is unable to find work. She is unable to find lodging. She takes up with some boarders. And the whole story is just this very close, very tightly written descent into abject poverty in Japan and this culture where they don't belong necessarily. Mm. It's a heartbreaking and a beautiful story, completely a different era, completely different time. But the stakes are just as high for these characters and the details are just beautiful. So I don't often recommend too many short stories on the show, but definitely that one came to mind as you read about Lily's descent.
Oh, I'm going to check that out for sure.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Zizi Packer, I love that whole collection, but that story is probably my favorite from it. So that would be a great one. It's very short. So definitely something I'd recommend. And Sarah, before we close out today, can you tell us a little bit about where we can find you and where we can find your books?
Yes. So, I have a website, sarahbennettwheeler.com, and my name is spelled W-E-A-L-E-R. It's kind of a unique way to spell Wheeler. I am on Instagram, S. Bennett Wheeler, and also Twitter, S. Bennett Wheeler. And my book, Grave Things Like Love, is coming out October 11th, and you can get it anywhere that you buy books. I also have another book out that came out a couple years ago called Now and When that is still available. So both of those, any place that you like to buy them, if they're not carrying it at the moment, I'm sure you can ask them to order it. That would be amazing. Maybe ask your independent bookseller to
order. Yes, for sure. We love our indies over here at YFB, and we'll have a link to buy the books as well for those of you that want to pick this up. I mean, obviously, who doesn't love a good fall read? And we're right in the season for that. We've got the cooler weather here to boot here in the Midwest.
Yes.
And Sarah, thank you so much for sharing your book with me, for getting me to read more Edith Wharton, who is rapidly becoming one of my favorite writers.
Yes.
And just thank you so much for your time.
Well, thanks for having me. This was so much fun.